Hello, you're watching Global Investor on Business Day TV. I'm Stephen Gagnon. On the show this evening, Caroline Kremen from AdviceWorks joins me for a wrap of global news making the headlines. Then in the second part of the show, we look at APSA's Global Property Feeder Fund, and that's with Hugo Matchin. All that coming your way shortly. First, though, a quick look at what's been making the headlines. Well, Brexit does not mean a certain exit. That's according to the man who drafted Article 50. According to the author, Britain still has a choice on whether to withdraw or proceed. This comes after Brexit talks have failed to gain sufficient traction 17 months after the UK voted to leave the EU. JCPenney has reported positive results for the first time in five quarters. The struggling retailer, which had to close 139 stores as part of its restructuring drive, has reported a 1.7% uptick in quarterly sales. Its shares have lost two-thirds of their value this year. And Alibaba's Singles Day sales blew past records, raking in more than $24 billion in 24 hours. In the opening 3 minutes, sales had already topped $1.5 billion. Annual sales from China's Singles Day have topped Black Friday and Cyber Monday sales combined. Take a look at this.
It's a one-day shopping frenzy that leaves Black Friday in the dust. Sales on Saturday's Singles Day in China hit more than $25 billion in 24 hours, an eye-popping figure that broke the event's previous records. The spending festival is led by Chinese e-commerce titan Alibaba, with users across the country hunting down bargains online and in stores, many of them snapping up deals from their phones.
This is our first time holding Singles Day on a weekend, on a Saturday, in today's wireless era. We have fully experienced in one day the changes in the way consumers live.
For years, Singles Day has racked up more sales than Black Friday and Cyber Monday combined. This year, after a star-studded event featuring Nicole Kidman and singer Pharrell Williams late Friday, the company said in just the first 2 minutes, pre-orders drove $1 billion of sales and $10 billion in just over an hour. Next comes a week of delivery blitz, with couriers and robots ready to move an estimated 1.5 billion packages.
Well, Caroline Kremen from AdviceWorks with me in studio now. So let's start off with Alibaba. $25 billion in sales in just 24 hours, up 40% from last year. It was on a weekend this year, and it's the first time that Singles Day has been held on a weekend. Do you think that helped to push the buying?
I don't think it made any difference whatsoever. I think this thing has just been increasing exponentially year after year after year. It's such a phenomenon. You know, when you actually look at those figures, okay, it's $25 billion, but put that in context of Amazon Prime Day, where the sales are between $1 and $2.2 billion, and the Black Friday Cyber Monday sales of Amazon, which are about $7 billion. You know, it just dwarfs those. I think there were at one stage 375,000 transactions per second being processed. It didn't crash. You know, take a lot to take note. You know, 175,000 on average. So it's just an absolute phenomenon. And if you look at its baby competitor, you know, JD.com, which is about 10% the size of Alibaba. Alibaba is about almost the same size as Amazon now. It doesn't do a single day. It does 11 days from the 1st of November to the 12th of November.
Okay.
But it had sales of $19 billion. So you're just looking, you know, we're so focused on Amazon, that we forget that there are similar platforms in China with 300 million consumers behind it, where the online shopping experience is just growing and growing. 90% of the sales on Alibaba came through their mobile app. It was actually processed with their own payment system, Alipay. So they even earned something from that. So from an investment case, you know, people need to stop focusing so much on the Amazon. And
do you like Alibaba?
I like Alibaba. I think it's probably a little bit expensive relative to JD and Amazon. You know, it's difficult to look at price to earnings ratios on these things because, you know, the earnings are relatively meaningless right now. But from a price to sales point of view, you know, Alibaba is not the best. The Amazon is second best, but JD Group is about 1.9. So it's actually looking relatively attractive. JD Group is structured very similarly to Amazon. Amazon has got this vertical integration. You know, where it's got its fulfillment centers and the orders come into Amazon, they go out from a fulfillment center. Alibaba is a little bit different in that it's a marketplace. So you'll have different stores and those suppliers are actually responsible for. So very, very different.
Okay, so it doesn't handle all the logistics.
No.
1.5 billion packages had to be delivered.
Well, and that's actually quite extraordinary. And I believe that something like the first package that went out at midnight on that night was delivered in under 13 minutes. Delivered in under 13 minutes.
Okay. Take note, one day only. It keeps you waiting for 2 weeks. Is there something about the Chinese consumer that tends towards online sales as opposed to kind of going into a physical shop?
You know, I just think that they're terribly tech savvy. You know, coming back to that payment system, 90% on Alipay. When you look at Amazon, it's only about 30% is actually going through mobile payment systems. So this is it's a consumer group, it's a society that lives on their cell phones in a way that I don't think we can really imagine. And they've really embraced that tech sector. You know, a lot of those things, you know, we take for granted, and especially where we live here in Sandton, that you can go to Sandton City and you can see all those wonderful brands. But if you're in, slightly more provincial towns in China, you're not necessarily going to see that, but you still want to spend and you've got money to spend. So it's just the right culture. And you know, the way they do it is with, you know, the big bands and they do a big show as the thing is about to start. So I think it just plays into that culture very, very effectively.
Well, let's move to physical retail because we've had quite a few companies in the US reporting, a few of the retailers there. And let's start off with JCPenney because we had that headline. And although it did report a wider loss for the quarter because it's been shutting down stores and I suppose paying off people, and I think it was discounting inventory, but same-store sales were up 1.7%, and that was unexpected.
Like-for-like sales, it was one of the few that actually had positive sales. Kohl's had positive sales of 0.1%, and of course Macy's was a disaster. It was down 4%. I wouldn't read too much into it. They're actually still down year on year, and it doesn't look like that trend is reversing anytime soon. All of these retailers, now they're not, you know, they're not your Walmart, your grocery retailers. They are your soft furnishings, you know, your apparel, your electronics goods. You know, they're just hemorrhaging to Amazon right now, chiefly Amazon. I think it's JCPenney is down 2/3, Macy's is down 50% this year. So it's not a sector that's going to turn around. They've done all the right things. You know, they've tried to control the inventory. They've instituted loyalty cards. They're decreasing floor space, closing stores. And yet, every single time you actually look at these companies and they're still in a lost position and I can't see that turning around imminently. Probably at some stage there is going to be, you know, a case for saying, look, they've hit rock bottom. I don't think retail is entirely dead. You know, I think we still do like to feel things, touch things, but I think we're moving into an era now where we actually just don't know what retail is going to look like in 5 years. You know, it's going to be vastly different from what we see now. And it's too difficult to call as to which one of those is really going to be better positioned, which one is going to have the best strategy, and which one is actually going to be around in 5 years.
And I suppose they can't compete with the likes of Amazon or Alibaba because of the physical infrastructure that they have to support.
Well, you know, there are other ways to play it. You know, you don't need one particular type of business case. If you look at Kohl's, I think Kohl's has actually got quite an interesting view of how they're going to position themselves, where you've seen JCPenney and Macy's close stores. All that Kohl's has said, they're going to keep the same amount of stores. They've got the biggest footprint, the most amount of stores of all of them, but they're going to reduce the size. Mm-hmm. And they're going to have computer systems where people can go in and actually see, well, if you like a dress and it's not that color, you know, it will actually be delivered to you. So a bit of a combination, and I think that's actually quite an interesting way to play it. It doesn't seem to be, you know, figuring in their financials yet,
soon.
but I think there is certainly scope for a business case other than the Amazon case. And I think even Amazon is going to the bricks and mortar route now. But it's early days yet.
Okay. So the UK told the Brexit is reversible and by the man who wrote Article 50.
Yes.
His name is John Kerr. I've never heard of him, but I suppose he's going to become famous now. And this comes as the EU wants clarity on the sort of financial obligations the UK is going to honour. I mean, do you see this pushing forward? We have, I think, 15 months until it actually triggers.
I don't really know what's going to happen there. I don't think Theresa May knows. I think there's such a confusion now. I think she did make a mistake in that she probably triggered the Article 50 too early. You know, you really want to trigger that when you've got a game plan as to what you're really going to do, yeah. And they really seem to be very clueless. It does look as if at some stage in the very imminent future, she might actually face a no-confidence vote, so she might not even be around. So you're faced with Britain, which has gone through potentially three different prime ministers during the most difficult period of their time, and you've got Jeremy Corbyn leaving on the side, so just really bad for that economy. In fact, Jeremy Corbyn probably frightens me more than Brexit, quite frankly.
Well, Carlton, still much confidence in investors, yeah. And also not instilling much confidence in investors, Donald Trump. So we have issues about his tax cuts last week, a bit of a juddo there, and he's also off in Asia at the moment signing trade deals with China.
Okay, the Chinese are very, very clever. You know, I think they've learned how to play this man. You know, they bring him there, they make very nice to him. I think he said something to Xi Jinping and turned around and said, you know, you're a very, very nice man, or very, you know, But I think the Chinese just look at this and say, this man is, quite frankly, an idiot. You know, we're going to give him a few trade deals or pass him off, and we'll just go back to business as usual, which is actually being very aggressive from a trade point of view. Mm-hmm. You know, expanding their Belt and Road program. And really, the U.S. is just standing on its own right now, you know, away from the rest of the world. Very, very negative for the U.S. long term.
Any concern that the Trump tax plan won't be pushed through, which could see, I suppose, a bit of a reversal on equity markets since they have been pricing it in?
You know, it's actually chaotic. You know, as you know, there's a House tax plan and there's a Senate tax plan, and they're not the same. And these guys are coming up for elections next year. You know, and you know, to get a decent, simplified, I don't think it's even a question of a tax cut. You want a simplified tax code because there's just too many deductions. But, you know, to start to simplify that means you need to start to take away some of those special interests and those special deductions. And that's going to hurt in the election because it can be used mm-hmm. against you. So I think people are looking at this just possibly from the personal level, that it's not going to play well to fiddle with that all that much. So I don't really hold out much hope for too much of a change on the personal income tax level. I think they're more likely to have some success on the corporate level.
Okay, that's from the 35 down to 20%.
Correct, and also the repatriation of foreign earnings. I think that's potentially less controversial and a little bit easier to do. But I think the market is really priced for perfection. You know, that we're going to have this low corporate rate. You know, everyone is going to get a nice big interest. You know, they'll have more earnings because their tax rate would have gone down. I'm not exactly sure how. And I think the reality is starting to set in a bit, and people are having their doubts. And I think it's going to be interesting to see which way it plays out. I don't have much hope, but I think there will be some type of reform. It's just not going to be the massive reform that they'd wanted.
Okay, well, we have to leave there for a moment. We're going to a short break. Mm-hmm. When we come back, we take a look at APSA's Global Property Feeder Fund. That's with Hugo Matchon. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. You're watching Global Investors. Still with me in studio, Caroline Kremen from AdviceWorks. We're also joined on the line by APSA's Hugo Matchon to look at their Global Property Feeder Fund. Hugo, thanks for joining us this evening. So it's a feeder fund, so basically investors are investing in RANDs, but into a basket of global property.
Yes, Stephen, that's right. Thank you very much for having me on the show. The purpose of the fund is to provide South African investors with a global and liquid real estate exposure. The fund actually takes a very sort of specific view, which is that of global cities. So we look to invest in the strongest urban economies out there.
So, because I noticed that the biggest exposure is to the United States, but your two top holdings are in Hong Kong. So I suppose that's the kind of global city you're looking at.
That's correct. I mean, if you look at the index ranking of global cities that we produce, you can see very clearly that there are some very strong Asian economies out there, China, Hong Kong, Singapore, and then also some of the North American cities, particularly the gateway cities on the West Coast, where you're seeing very strong economic performance from the knowledge-based economies and the demand for real estate in those cities.
So what essentially are you looking for when you do identify those global cities? What what makes up for a global city. Would London be there despite Brexit?
Yes, London would be there despite Brexit. I mean, being researchers, we very much look at factors in terms of building a model and ranking. So it's very much an impassioned view, if you like, from a demand, economic demand perspective. London still ranks very highly for us, given that you have a very broad-based economy, and you know you have lots of top-ranked universities. And so for us, we still view London as a good place to invest from a real estate perspective.
Mm. Caroline, what's your thoughts on that, identifying those global cities like Hong Kong, like London, like those West Coast cities that Hugo spoke about?
You know, I think there's an increasing move, you know, for people to actually go to those global cities. So I don't think you can be very far wrong in actually investing in property in any one of those global centres. I think the question really is, are you going to get the exchange rate right and how the exchange rate in those particular territories are going to move? So I'm curious, your fund actually consists of exchange rate swaps. Are those dollar hard currency or are they rand hard currency? Swaps.
Yes, so the way that it works at the moment is you have local currency exposure, which then gets brought back into rand, into local currency there. So yes, there is an element of taking that that foreign exchange exposure, but our view is that over time that. To a certain degree, it's going to be to a very large degree, it's going to be the performance of the underlying companies that we're investing in. And the way that our process is set up and the way that we look at investing in global real estate is very much a stock picker's fund. So we look for, the way that we sort of term it is that twin moat effect of the strongest global cities economies and then the strongest companies within their subsectors. So we're essentially looking for those kind of local sharpshooters, which South African investors wouldn't necessarily be able to have exposure to outside of, you know, really investing in a fund such as this.
So Hugo, with the exchange rate swaps, does that mean the investor doesn't get the full benefits of the currency swings, particularly if they're going in favour of the rand or in favour of a rand hedge?
Yeah, so we're looking to sort of smooth that currency exposure to a certain degree, but it's one of those things that there's a timing impact there, isn't there? So you're never going to totally escape your currency exposure, but as I say, the idea being is that, you know, we're very much looking at this as a long-term investment, and from a long-term perspective, we would say to clients that looking at these very strong, you know, global city economies, very strong companies, that is, you know, ultimately what you're investing in over long periods of time. Currency is something that is kind of more intermittent.
How about the currency environment? So looking more short-term, and particularly with rising interest rates in the UK and also in the United States, does that change your approach to any of those global cities, maybe reducing exposure to some jurisdictions, increasing exposure in others?
Well, actually, Stephen, the, you know, a potentially rising interest rate environment is a very interesting question for real estate, because again, it goes back to this fund and the relatively unique characteristics that it has in terms of the exposure that it takes, which is, if you're looking at the best of the best, one of the mantras that we always sort of talk about with this fund is that of pricing power. And if you've got pricing power in the strongest urban economies, it gives you that ability to weather increased interest rates. The opposite of that, really, from a real estate perspective, is where you're just investing for yield as opposed to total return. And this fund is very much a total return proposition. The yield investors in real estate are vulnerable to interest rate rises, because you're basically taking a bit of a bond proxy. As your cost of funds go up, your returns are reduced. So we're very much a total return investor.
Appealing to you, Caroline?
Not particularly. You know, I either like lots of yield or lots of growth, and this is one of those that really doesn't give you a lot of yield, and it's not really high growth. You know, if you look at, and it's not fund specific. I think the fund is very, very nice. It's probably the sector specific. Globally, it hasn't been a stellar performer. You know, you it's probably not the, the greatest place to park your money if you want an enormous amount of growth or even a medium type of growth. But it is a safe place to put your money, you know. So if you are possibly one of those investors, you know, in a preservation or a pension fund, or you know, to actually park a few of these assets, it's not bad. I think there are cheaper alternatives. The total expense ratio here is 2.87%, and you know, if you look at the South African ETF market, you know, there's two ETFs there that actually come in underneath that, that do a very, very similar thing.
Yeah. So. I mean, Hugo, are you seeing competition from the ETF markets, and particularly in South Africa, where there have been a couple of global property ETFs launched over the past year?
Yeah, I think it's a very good point, because I think it goes back to the heart of the active management business in terms of funds. So what I would say is that the way that our process is, a very systematic process, is set up, it's impossible for the ETFs to replicate. And we would actually, funnily enough, we would urge clients that if they want a very generic global real estate exposure, that the ETFs are a good place to go if that's what they're looking for. On the very, very sort of other end of the spectrum, the global cities approach that we take is not possible to replicate. So the 56 names that we own in this portfolio, or we have investments in this portfolio, have a very specific risk-return profile, and quite a concentrated portfolio as well, is something that we're very comfortable with, because the degree to which we underwrite those positions, we think that will provide a very good risk-adjusted compound return to our clients over a long period of time. So it's really, I think that the area that we would question, and being objective about this, is really those kind of commoditized real estate exposures that charge an active fee. I think it's absolutely fine to charge an active fee, provided you provide clients with exactly what they're looking for in terms of a fund that does something slightly different. And we would, you know, argue that this fund does exactly that.
Okay. Apart from the geographical diversification that you're getting through the mix of the US and Asia Pacific region, etc., how about across different sectors within mm-hmm. property itself? So I see you have some Hong Kong property developers in there. You have industrial real estate. Any particular areas that you do like at the moment?
Yeah, there's plenty, and I think that's a very good point, because the mantra is very much, you know, not all cities are created equally and not all real estate is created equally. And in fact, if you sort of look under the bonnet a little bit, there's some specific subsectors of real estate that are doing very well. You know, the great shopping center in the sky, as we like to call it, is really impacting on shopping malls in terms of the demand from e-tailing. But that demand is actually being transposed to warehouses where customers need goods stored and then delivered, you know, into those very large urban cities or global cities that we've spoken about. So that's one area of serious interest, and how technology is really changing the real estate scene is really quite rapid and quite marked. And another area as well that we like and that we have exposure to is data centers. I mean, literally the storage of, you know, your data, the closer and to a large global city on a super fiber highway, the stronger the return that you can potentially make. So again, you can see how technology in our everyday lives is changing the demand for real estate. And we very much look at the way that we can capture that within the fund.
I mean, we were chatting about this earlier in the show about JCPenney and some of its peers closing down stores or cutting back on space because of the growth of the likes of Amazon and Alibaba. So that's something you're seeing, more demand for warehouses and something you would want to invest in.
That's correct, Stephen. I mean, what we're seeing as well is that warehouses that are really located in very, very close proximity to big city centres are having huge rental demand, or seeing huge rental demand. You know, if you look at, in particular in the US, where there's a lot more retail space per capita than anywhere else in the world, if you look at those very generic B and C grade malls, they're really struggling to get people through the doors, because the experience is basically commoditized. So a lot of the stuff that you can buy there, you can just as easily buy online. So there's a very, very clear, in real estate terms, a very clear transference of value between B and C grade type malls and warehouses close to major city centers.
Okay. And maybe just finally, I see you've got a tiny percentage in emerging markets. Which emerging markets are those? And are you seeing opportunities in emerging markets at the moment?
Yeah, good spot. We have a small exposure to a company in Mexico City. Mexico City ranks very highly on our index. This company ticks all the boxes for us, and you know we've been to see all the assets. You know we pride ourselves on being able to kick the tires. In terms of broader sort of emerging markets as well, we undertake extensive due diligence, but. You know, if there is a higher degree of risk in potentially an emerging market or a developing market, then that will be reflected in the size of the exposure that we'll take. But if everything does stack up and it does align from a process point of view, then we're happy to take that exposure.
Hugo, and we have to leave it there with you. Thank you very much for joining us this evening, Hugo. Caroline, you get the last word. And I suppose we have seen a move to specialty real estate in South Africa as well, with storage and the likes, and also warehousing type, Equites, which is a warehouse
this
type real estate company.
This is probably one of the few areas that is actually growing globally, and you just got to remember that the margins on those things are not as good as they were in the retail space, but I don't think we're ever going back there. Look, I think it's a very good quality underlying selections within this fund, but that whole sector, the performances, especially overseas, is not that great. You know, so if you have a 9-month performance of 6.23 and you take nearly 3% fee off that, it's just not looking that attractive.
But it's a safe haven.
It's a potentially yes.
Potentially. Yeah. Caroline, we have to leave it. Thank you very much for coming through. That's all we have for the show this week. Thanks again to Hugo and Caroline for their insights. Many thanks to you for watching. Same time next week. Goodbye.